Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Doug Tribou.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. And let's begin with the latest in the case of Alexander Ciccolo, who's facing a detention hearing today in Springfield. Federal agents arrested the 23-year-old man from Western Massachusetts on July 4th in connection with an alleged plot inspired by the Boston Marathon bombers to attack a university.
U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz has filed documents that detail a plan to set off explosives and open fire at a cafeteria at an unnamed university. Ciccolo was arrested after allegedly receiving firearms from an FBI witness.
With the latest on this still unfolding story, we're joined by WBUR senior reporter David Boeri. Hi, David.
Hey, Anthony.
So bring us up to date. There's a lot of information about the government's case in court records that have been unsealed. What have we learned?
What's interesting, Anthony, looking at the details here, this could be any number of people we've seen before just by a different name. What makes this somewhat unusual is that his father, a Boston police captain, notified the FBI in the fall of 2014 that his son had been obsessed with Islam for the last 2 years, was going over the deep end, that he wanted to get involved in the fight for ISIS. And so that's what alerted the FBI in 2014. On Facebook, the FBI found Ali al-Amriki, that's one and the same as Ciccolo, and it's striking how often people who become government targets, not surprisingly though, go on social media to announce their fascination with ISIS, they're seeking a martyrdom, and even celebrating acts of violence that have been committed by ISIS against the kafir, the non-believers. So that's how they became aware of him, and they've been following him ever since last fall.
And since then, as you said, the FBI has been following him, and agents essentially devised a plan to catch him, right? What happened?
Well, that's right, and it begins with a typical time-honored tactic of the FBI. They get an informant, a cooperating witness, a CW, the informant goes in wired, and so we have the statements from Ciccolo in surround sound here to present to the court, both in the complaint and now no doubt today. So they then start meeting him in June, and by then he is talking quite openly about attacks. He celebrates that terrorist ISIS-connected attack on tourists in Tunisia at the latter part of June, in which 38 people were killed. He starts talking, and this is all, and I should say, this is all according to the affidavit and the complaint. These are the allegations, but I'm conveying them to you, that he started talking about attacking police that shifted to a college, a university. That university is known to the FBI, but they have not released its name in their affidavit or the U.S. attorney in her complaint. But it takes on that tone. He's talking, and this is particularly disturbing, I think, to hear. He's talking about pressure cookers. He actually bought a pressure cooker at the beginning of July when this case went into overdrive. He talks about black powder, getting black powder, being inspired by the Tsarnaev brothers, getting ball bearings, and then setting it, unleashing it at a place where he can see the damage. At that point in early July, the FBI agents closed in. Now came the sting, in which they suggested that he probably was looking for guns. He had said he wanted guns, that they might be able to help. And sure enough, they did help him. They acquired 4 guns. They handed them over to Ciccolo, and then they arrested him on the 4th of July.
Okay. So We're also learning that Ciccolo has a history of mental illness. So, David, what does this mean for this case, do you think?
It's a good question. We will find out when David Hoos, the criminal defense attorney, well-known in Western Massachusetts, enters here the hearing today, and whether he makes a case of it. This will not be the first suspect with problems of mental illness. You remember Rezwan Firdaus from Ashland, who was convicted in a terrorist-related plot in which he was said to want to fly drones into the U.S. Capitol building. He had been reported, according to police reports, somebody had called the Hopkinton police one night or a year or two earlier. He was urinating on himself in the street, signs clearly of mental illness. He was convicted. So we'll find out what kind of what effect this might have and whether this is going to enter into the defense.
Now, David, after Ciccolo was arrested on July 4th, did he actually speak with FBI agents? Are they saying that he spoke with them?
The affidavit says he waived his Miranda warnings, did not want to talk about the gun charges, but said, yes, he wanted to support ISIS. And that was his intent.
All right. Now, according to the Boston Globe, a spokesman for Carmen Ortiz, the U.S. Attorney, declined to say if Ciccolo would be charged with any terrorism-related offenses. But does it sound to you like it's going in that direction?
They're certainly going to try. Remember, in the search warrants, they found partially constructed Molotov cocktails in his house. They also found styrofoam that had been shredded in motor oil to create, according to the affidavit, an effect, something like napalm, of a sticky burning material that would be on your skin. Remember, though, as disturbing as this is a lot of talk, disturbing talk. At this point, he is charged with felon in possession of a firearm. And what's ironic here is that that charge is related to a previous felony he committed, which made him eligible for this particular charge. And that felony is that somebody who had been obsessed with Islam for the last 2 years was charged and convicted of drunk driving in January.
That's David Boeri, WBUR senior reporter, talking about the latest in the case of Alexander Ciccolo. David, thank you.
Welcome.
As we've noted, we do not yet know whether Alexander Ciccolo will be charged with terrorism-related offenses, but what we know so far about his case does echo earlier terrorism cases. To put those types of investigations into context, we're joined now by Seth Jones, director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation. He's also the author of Hunting in the Shadows, The Pursuit of Al-Qaeda After 9/11. Seth, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks. It's great to be on.
Let's start with the Ciccolo case specifically. What details stand out to you?
Well, there are a couple of details that make this particularly interesting. One is this is yet another example, and we've seen dozens over the past several months, of someone being inspired by the Islamic State. They've spread out from Syria and Iraq into North Africa, West Africa, East Africa, and even into South Asia. We've also seen a range of plots start to surface in the U.S. So this is yet another example. A second issue is the importance of social media in helping radicalize individuals, and we've seen that in this case with everything from his Facebook profile under the name Ali al-Amriki to a range of other messages that he was sending out. And then finally, the third issue is this, the assault-style attacks with rifles and pressure cookers rather than these big, sophisticated 9/11-style attacks seems to be the modus operandi of many of these individuals, at least in today's era.
This isn't the first time we've heard of a person allegedly becoming radicalized in part through their online activity. We had Usama Rahim shot by Boston police here in Boston. He was allegedly plotting to attack police officers. Is there a common profile for the suspects in these so-called lone wolf cases?
The challenge actually is that there is no real common profile of suspects. If you look at some of the recent evidence that's come out over the past year with individuals who have been arrested for plotting attacks inspired by the Islamic State, they're male and female, they're young and old, they're U.S. citizens, they're lawful permanent residents, some have been refugees or asylum seekers. They come from not just the United States, but they have ethnic ties to a range of places overseas, and they're actually happening in every state in the U.S., so it's become really impossible in many ways to profile suspects.
Well, that brings me to a point that I find myself thinking about in these cases is this sort of needle in the haystack factor. In this case, Alexander Chikolo's a family member brought this to the attention of the authorities, and then the investigation went from there. But what can authorities do when that's not the case?
Well, that's obviously very difficult. In cases where there is not a tip given to the police, that you really have to resort with law enforcement to proactive intelligence. Najibul Azazi was captured in 2009. He was plotting attacks in New York City. He was captured because he sent an email to an Al-Qaeda facilitator in Pakistan that was being monitored by British and American intelligence agencies. So that was proactive intelligence. In the case of David Headley, who was captured also in 2009, plotting attacks from Chicago to Copenhagen, Denmark, the British actually passed intelligence to the U.S. of his activities because he had met folks there in Britain. So where there's no tip, then it really relies on very good coverage, intelligence coverage, human coverage, signals intelligence coverage of individuals. But it's very difficult without a tip.
Coming back to the Chikolo case, in some similar tones to other investigations we've seen in recent years, the FBI offered to provide him money to buy bomb-making materials, provided the guns that he was eventually arrested with. Is there a fine line here for investigators between catching someone and pushing him into doing something?
There is a fine line, and thankfully, living in the United States, anybody, including Chikolo in this case, will have to go through the U.S. legal system. And so the FBI and other law enforcement efforts here will be subject to close scrutiny. Now, in past cases, what we've seen is that individuals with an intent, a desire, and an interest in plotting a terrorist attack have generally been convicted, even when the FBI has helped provide some assistance along the lines, whether it's guns, as in the case of the Fort Dix plotters, or knowledge in the case of the two women from New York recently arrested. Again, what this will hinge on really is intent, and what is the evidence on his intent, regardless of assistance from the FBI here, of committing a terrorist attack or other kind of attack. And that's where really this is going to hinge on. But it is a very fine line.
In this case, Chikolo's family has said that he struggled with mental illness over the years. I know you said earlier that there's no set profile, but we have heard of other cases where that's also been at play. Is mental illness a common thread in these sorts of cases?
Actually, it's not. The vast majority of terrorist plots we see in the United States, or even in the West more broadly, individuals are not mentally ill. Their focus really is on some sort of radicalization and intent to target. Some cases it's religious extremism, which this appears to be in part, and where Garland, Texas, plot was. In other cases, it may be right or left-wing extremism, including in the case we saw recently in South Carolina at the African-American church. But mental illness is actually rarely a motivation in terrorism cases.
In the years after 9/11, we heard a lot about terror cells and groups working together. But more recently, ISIS and Al-Qaeda have issued calls urging for individual actors. Is that the next big threat to us here in the United States?
I think it is. When you look at the propaganda from Al-Qaeda and ISIS, their magazines like Inspire and Dabiq, those organizations are calling for individuals in the United States and in the West to conduct these kinds of attacks that are alleged in this case in the Boston area. And they're doing this in part because it's easier to pull off an attack like this that may require guns that are easy to acquire in the United States, or rudimentary bombs, pressure cookers that can be bought, rather than the kind of attacks we've seen on September 11th or in London on 7/7 or even in Madrid that are very sophisticated attacks against multiple transportation targets at the same time and require a lot of preparation beforehand. These are much easier to strike, and frankly, they're easier to strike. You can see that in this pattern over the last couple of months in attacks in Copenhagen, Denmark, in Paris, France, in Sydney, Australia, Garland, Texas, Brussels, Belgium, and even Ottawa, Canada, north of the U.S. border. So this pattern is really emerging of these kinds of attacks.
Hmm. Seth Jones is the director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation. He's also the author of Hunting in the Shadows, The Pursuit of Al-Qaeda Now After 9/11. Seth, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
And stay with us. Coming up, we'll check in with Congressman Seth Moulton and get his reaction on the Iran nuclear deal. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Doug Tribou. This is Radio Boston.